Du lyssnar på Framgångspodden i samarbete med Acast.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Discover Hydro, the best kept secret in fitness. Hydro is the state-of-the-art at-home rower that engages 86% of your muscles, delivering the ultimate full-body workout in just 20 minutes. From advanced to beginner, Hydro has over 500 classes shot worldwide and taught by Olympians and world-class athletes. For a 30-day risk-free trial, go to Hydro.com and use code ROW450 to save $450 on a Hydro Pro rower. That's HYDROW.com, code ROW450.
Något som har fascinerat mig otroligt mycket senaste tiden, det är ju verkligen AI. Alltså det exploderar ju fram, det går ju som tåget och det är så snabbt att vi inte ens kommer att hänga med. Och det är verkligen så här, vad är det som händer just nu? Kommer vi gå till att det kommer bli en till art på vår planet? Att vi som människor kommer att utrotas? Vad kommer hända med våra jobb? Skolan? Hur kommer det fungera i framtiden? Och för att lösa de här olika frågorna så kollade jag upp vilka är bland de absolut vassaste i världen. Och vi har faktiskt en svensk som är det, och det är Nick Boström som är professor på Oxford University. Han är en polare med Elon Musk. Han rankas som en av de 50 främsta filosoferna i världen och gjort över 200 publikationer och släppt massor av böcker. Alltså han är en gud på det här området och är stor respekt över hela världen. Så att jag har fått den stora, stora äran att ha honom i ett samtal och prata om just de här sakerna. Vad kommer hända med superintelligens? Vad kommer hända med machine learning? Och det här som folk kallar AI, vad är det för någonting? Och liksom, jag lovar, alltså jag har suttit med massa experter nu senaste tiden och jag är helt blown away på det här. Och det kommer ske så, alltså så stora förändringar vi inte ens har någon aning om. Och en del av det kommer att föra i det här avsnittet med ingen mindre än professor Nick Boström.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Let me introduce you to maybe one of the biggest podcasts in the world. Framgångspodden with Alexander Palaros.
Warm, welcome to Framgångspodden, Nick Boström.
Hey.
Very, very nice to have you here. How are you?
So far, so good.
That's great. That's great. And can you tell me a little bit by yourself? You're born in Sweden, but it feels like you're a guy that's like the best one, best Swedish guy in the world right now, who is a friend with a lot of people and you talk with a lot of people and you are out there and looking for the future.
Yeah. I guess I'm doing a lot of things, but yeah. No, I did grow up in Sweden, and I'm Swedish, and can speak a little bit Swedish. I understand it perfectly, but the actual output is sort of rusty. Not having spoken Swedish in several decades now.
And what do you do?
Well, I'm a philosopher. I suppose you could use that label. Although I don't really tend to make a sharp separation between philosophy on the one hand and science on the other. I think of it more as a continuum. What I'm really interested in are certain big picture questions for humanity, understanding our place in the world, what the future might hold, in order then perhaps to get some hints and clues about what we might do to nudge things in a more positive direction. So this has kind of been my big quest since I was a teenager, and I'm still pursuing it.
What is it you are working with right now?
Well, I just completed a book, Deep Utopia, which was maybe 5 or 6 years in the works. And so now I want to take, like, you know, when you're trying to finish a book, you have to kind of put the blinkers on to focus, you know, prevent yourself yeah. from being interested in stuff.
Yeah.
And so now I want to take those off and look around and explore, take stock of where things are in the world. And I do have a whole inventory of ideas that I might pursue. And in fact, have started sketching on a paper, but very early stage.
I was looking at your TEDx you've done and one of them was like amazing. And you said something that was very interesting. You said like machine intelligence is the last invention that humanity will ever need to make. Can you explain that further?
Well, the explanation is very simple. Once AI succeeds and is able to do all the things that the human brain can do, then that includes, as a special case, the process of inventing stuff. So doing scientific and technological research. It's one of the things the human brain can do. And so when AI can do everything the human brain can do, it can also then do the inventing and the discovery and the design and engineering. And if, as I believe is the case, that shortly after we have machines that can do everything that the human brain can do, we will have machines that can do it much better and much faster, then we face a kind of obsolescence in the intellectual space. And in particular, I think we can expect to see a dramatic increase in the rate of technological progress at that point, when the progress is being driven by these super intelligences.
Are we at that point now, or when is that point?
Well, that's the $80,000 question. I think things are happening in the space of AI. The last several years have seen really remarkable progress, to the point where now I think we cannot rule out extremely short timelines of like a year or two. It might well take longer. It might take a couple of decades or something. But I don't think we are in a position to be extremely confident that it couldn't happen, say, within, you know, 2 or 3 years, even though maybe most likely it will take a bit longer than that. So we've seen, particularly with these large language models, that as you scale them up, the performance increases. So going from, you know, GPT-1 to GPT-2, big step, GPT-2 to GPT-3, that's really when it started to capture the public imagination. And then to GPT-4, a whole other additional level of capability. And it remains to be seen what will happen when you then take like one or two more steps in this direction, GPT-5, GPT-6.
What is GPT?
Yeah, this is the AI, the most famous AI that OpenAI has released. And it's a large transformer architecture, as it's known in the literature, but it's basically a big neural network that has ingested most of the text on the internet and been trained on that. And as a consequence, has acquired various capabilities, including the ability to understand natural speech. You can have a dialogue with it. It can program, write computer code. It can solve mathematics problems, write poems, summarize large text documents, answer scientific questions.
Right.
It's quite a remarkable artifact. And more recent versions of it also are starting to have multimodal capabilities, which means not just text, but also the ability to look at pictures or video and understand what's in those images, and also being able to output images or video or voice. And so if one were to extrapolate, this is always a dangerous thing to do, but if we kind of take the last 5 years of progress in AI and imagine the next 5 years will have as much progress, then I think that would probably bring us all the way there.
Can we start a little bit from the beginning? If you would explain like the how the human has the human development has been on planet Earth. If you would explain that as a timeline, so you understand what's happening right now and how much development we had before in the history, can you explain that from the beginning?
Well, we tend to regard the current way that things are as somehow the normal way for things to be. Like the idea that, you know, maybe you wake up in the morning with an alarm clock and then you shove down a cup of coffee and you commute to work and then you sit in front of a desk all day long and then you go home and you struggle not to eat too much and maybe you watch some television. Like all of these things are like radical anomalies, really, if you zoom out and look at it from a reasonable perspective. Obviously, throughout human history, this modern era of material abundance and computers, etc., represents like the thinnest little slice, like a thin coat of paint on a massive big object. And if you zoom out further, our species, you know, depending on exactly how you count, has been around for maybe 200,000 years, where even all of human history is like a thin sliver. And then we have like the entire history of life stretching back billions of years beyond that. And so on the temporal axis, this current human condition is like just like the weirdest anomaly, some aberration. Like if you plot, for example, global gross domestic product, like the size of the economy, and you do this back to prehistory, say like 10,000 years ago, it's basically a flat line followed by a vertical line. And you can't really see any structure. It's just like nothing happened and then everything happened. Now, of course, things did happen in the flat line. It's just it's so little happened so slowly that it doesn't show up on a linear plot. Mm. So I think this gives some context. You might think, and it's a sensible heuristic in general, like extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Right. If somebody claims something completely strange and odd and surprising, then you expect them to have pretty good evidence if you're going to accept the claim. Like, whereas if somebody claims the sun will rise tomorrow, then you don't have to present a lot of evidence. That's kind of more or less the way things used to be, right? And so you might think similarly, this claim, let's say, that it's quite likely that we will be surpassed by machine superintelligence, maybe within our lifetimes, is like an extraordinary claim. Or that something else will happen, humankind will go extinct, or some equally radical transformation that would require extraordinary evidence. But I think once you zoom out and realize just how abnormal the current condition is, I think it becomes a lot more plausible to expect that one thing or another radically will probably change over a timescale of 100 years or so or less, just given how much has changed in the previous decades and centuries.
Can you explain what's different between a human brain, so we understand, and what the possibility with and the possibilities with the AI is? What is the difference between AI and the human brain?
Well, the human brains exist in fairly large numbers. They haven't really changed that much, over hundreds of thousands of years. The details of the exact way that our neurons are wired up to one another does change all the time as we learn and our culture evolves. But the basic architecture, the fundamental physical property, like the speed at which individual neurons operate or the number of neurons we have, that has pretty much been constant for many, many thousands of years. Whereas AIs, of course, they didn't exist at all until... we had electronic computers, or, in the 40s maybe, and then sometimes the birth of the field of artificial intelligence, you could say 1956. It's slightly arbitrary, but that's often regarded as the birth year of the field of AI. So it's a very recent thing. And of course, it started in very rudimentary fashion. The computers back then were too slow to really do anything very interesting, except in a few domains like calculating large numbers and stuff like that. That AIs have long surpassed us, right? And then you had like chess playing AIs that beat Garry Kasparov. You had a sort of incremental progress, but the paradigm for most of these decades since 1956 was dominated by so-called good old-fashioned AI. And this was the paradigm where you have human engineers that kind of define particular rules. Like you have you program in a bunch of knowledge, like a big database of propositions. And then the AI can make like simple logical deductions from that. But you sort of get out only what you put in. And the whole system is very fragile. So if you try to scale it, you put in one wrong proposition, it might all just spew out nonsense. And these had very these kind of expert systems had very limited practical utility. But what's happened since 2010, 2012 is the focus has shifted from building these big expert systems to machine learning. And we have the deep learning revolution that really started gathering steam. And so now the focus is on crafting learning algorithms that can learn from a wide range of different data to sort of become more skilled at performing various tasks. Like neural networks have been around since way before 2010, but they didn't really work so well before, primarily because the computers weren't really big enough to run sufficiently large neural nets. But it's long seemed like a promising avenue. I mean, I remember back when it must have been like in the late 80s, maybe, or like I was, they still had conscription in Sweden. I think and as a 17, like all 17-year-old males had to go into these army recruitment centers. I remember being driven in a bus there. So there were like 2 days of various, like batteries of different physical and psychological tests. And I had this book with me that I got from interlibrary loan that I still remember, Parallel Distributed Processing. It was like one of the early volumes on artificial neural networks that I was reading with immense fascination. And it seemed to me that this was kind of on the path, this neural network approach. And later I studied computational neuroscience as like in London as a graduate student. But around 2010, 2012, that's really when this started to work. The thing that really kicked it off was some researchers figured out that you could take these GPUs, graphics processing units, these chips designed to make computer games have more impressive graphics. And if you ran the neural nets on those, as opposed to the CPUs, like the standard sort of Intel processor that run Microsoft Word, then you got like a boost of 100x because these graphics processing units, they like basically designed to process a whole bunch of, make a lot of simple operations in parallel. Just because like you have a screen basically just has a bunch of pixels so you can kind of process each one in parallel. And so similarly, you could run a big neural network on these. And that kind of 100x boost really took them over the level where they became practically useful. So you could start to do image recognition that really worked. And since then, we've kind of been on this accelerating upwards trajectory. DeepMind was like a pioneer of a bunch of these original systems. They designed this AlphaGo system that beat the human champion in Go, which was a big milestone because it showed that AIs could be really good, not just at doing logic and sort of math, but at intuition and pattern recognition. So like human Go players, it's like this massive game in Asia. People train since childhood, spend full time, become professional Go players, like decades of just studying this. Like, and it's like very deeply strategic pattern recognition. You get the feel for the board, right? You don't calculate out exactly everything. You just have to. So AlphaGo beat the like then human champion in Go, which suggested like now if they can do both kind of logic calculation stuff and they can do pattern recognition and form abstractions, then like what can't they do? And then with these large language models, it's like a kind of a tweak of this neural network architecture, like the transformer models. It's like a little thing with like attention added to it, and that was like another step change forward. And which takes us to the current moment where like things are happening extremely rapidly, and now there's a scramble to try to get, for these key frontier labs that want to be competitive in this AI race to get their hands on enough AI chips. Because it does look like to be competitive now, you can't just have some little academic project with, you know, free workstations. Like you need massive data centers with like 10,000 GPUs. Like maybe the next generation will require even more than that. And these are like, you know, multiple $1 billion investments. And even then, it's hard. Like NVIDIA is basically sold out. This is like the main company that. It's now maybe the key driver is like actual access to the right kind of AI chips.
If we jump into the existential risk for the humanity, I talked to a friend of mine that also are a scientist in AI, and he said like the AI is and the machine learning is much high risk than nuclear weapons. And can you explain to me what would be the worst scenario for the humanity?
Yeah, no, I mean the kind of archetypal AI doom scenario is that we develop a machine, some AI system that becomes super intelligent, maybe initially weakly super intelligent, but it might then perhaps use its greater than human intelligence to design even more intelligent versions of itself. So you get maybe a kind of boom or like a rapid leap up to higher levels of super intelligence. And then you would have a world where you have this radically superhuman intellect that is much better able to plan strategically to maybe persuade humans to invent new technologies, to hack computational infrastructure, all kinds of capabilities that plausibly would come along with this package of cognitive abilities. So it would potentially be extremely powerful for the same reason that we humans are really powerful relative to the gorillas or the chimpanzees, right? It's not because we have bigger muscles. Like, in fact, a chimpanzee can kind of rip us apart. We slightly smarter brains. And really, it's not that big a difference if you just look at the actual chimp brain and the human brain. Like, you scale it up by a factor of two and some small tweaks, and that's basically... But that unlocks, like, a whole different level of power because we can then invent new technologies. We can coordinate. We can plan. We can... So now the fate of the gorillas depend a lot more on what we decide to do than on what the gorillas decide to do. So their fate is in our hands. And similarly, if we develop machine superintelligence that is maybe, you know, far more superior to us cognitively than we are to chimpanzees, then our fate would rest in their hands, in their will. So it then depends on exactly what they want, what are their goals. Because whatever the goals are, they probably would be able to achieve them. So the first part of the kind of case for why AI could pose an existential risk is superintelligence possibly would be extremely powerful and able to achieve its goals. And the second part then is, well, a lot then depends on what goals we give it. So ideally, we would want to align it with human values and human intentions. But it turns out that looks really technically difficult to build a system such that even as it maybe improves its intelligence and eventually becomes radically super intelligent, can we design it in such a way that it is still aligned and does what we intend for it to do?
Yeah, and not evil, because we are also very evil.
That's an additional problem. But even setting aside that, even if we assume that whoever builds this is perfectly well-intentioned, there is already a technical problem there for them to be able to get the AI to do what they want. So this is the technical alignment problem. Now, you're right. Assuming that was solved so that whoever builds the AI can get it to do what they ask of it, then there's the additional problem that you could call it the governance problem of how to make sure that that actually results in a good outcome, like that that people don't use it for excessively selfish or evil or malicious purposes.
Yeah, it's also very, very hard to set the goal. And like for our brain, are we the right humans or the right people or the right organism to, are we smart enough to put the right goal on the AI? And you can give us some example for that, that we maybe think this is the right goal we put on AI, but if you have like a super intelligence robot or with machine learning AI, it in the end can be very bad.
Yeah, so the right goal, so this, and this is true. So if we imagine, this is like the famous or infamous paperclip AI example. You imagine you design this super intelligence and you give it the goal to make as many paperclips as possible. You know, maybe you want it to operate a paperclip factory and make you a lot of money. Then this AI, whose goal is to maximize the number of paperclips, would have instrumental reasons to do various other things that would be bad for us. For a start, it would have an instrumental reason to prevent us from shutting it off. Not because it has like any life instinct or desire to not die, but because it calculates that there will be fewer paperclips if that AI is shut down. Since if it's not shut down, it will continue to sort of try to influence the world to contain more paperclips. So right off the bat, you have this kind of convergent instrumental reason for self-preservation. Another example would be an instrumental reason to try to improve its own intelligence further so that it can figure out better ways to make paperclips. Another example would be to prevent us from changing its goal, because it can now, while it still wants to make as many paperclips as possible, predict that if we change its goals to like something else, like to make staples instead, right, then there will probably be fewer paperclips in the future. Mm. And so it will resist attempts. And that might then result in it, for example, deceiving us about what its true goal is, if it calculates that if we found out that it actually is only going to try to make paperclips, we would change its goal. So you then have the possibility of strategic deception, which makes a lot of these methods that we use today to shape the AI's preferences and goals no longer reliable, because like they rely on us observing its performance in a training environment and then assuming that it will perform similarly in the deployment scenario. But if the AI is smart enough in training to realize that it is currently in training and being observed and monitored, it could then kind of pretend to have a different goal than it actually has. So there's like a whole bunch of complications that come in from A, the fact that almost any arbitrary goal would result in these instrumental reasons for self-preservation, etc., and for trying to attain more power, and then the strategic capability of the AI, then making possible for the AI to deceive us or to like do various things that would make it harder to train this out of the AI. So this is like a technical challenge. Now the situation has changed a lot. So my previous book, Superintelligence, came out in 2014, and I had been working on it for 6 years before then. And at that time, this alignment problem was completely ignored and neglected, certainly in academia, but really more broadly in the world. I mean, there were like a handful of people on the internet who were like trying to think about this, but which was the main reason for writing the book. Like, it seemed perfectly foreseeable that we will eventually figure out how to make machines really smart, and then we will confront this alignment problem. And moreover, as the book tried to show, a lot of the initial ideas one might have for how one would solve the alignment problem actually wouldn't work. So it looks like it's a difficult problem, and we should probably, you know, start working on it while we still have time. But in the intervening years, this has become much more widely recognized. Both the idea that we might have transformative AI in the relatively near future, and that it could pose existential risks because there's a really difficult problem of AI alignment. And so now all the frontier AI labs have research groups specifically trying to develop scalable methods for AI alignment. And many other research groups as well are working on this. So that's like a big change in the world. It's been quite remarkable just over 10 years.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Dealing with mental health can be hard, but United Healthcare can help make getting care easier. With Mental Health Complete Plus, provided by Teladoc Health. Unlimited virtual sessions for only $59.99 a month. Visit mentalhealthcomplete.com to learn more.
Discover Hydro, the best kept secret in fitness. Hydro is the state-of-the-art at-home rower that engages 86% of your muscles, delivering the ultimate full-body workout in just 20 minutes. From advanced to beginner, Hydro has over 500 classes, shot worldwide and taught by Olympians and world-class athletes. For a 30-day risk-free trial, go to Hydro.com and use code ROW450 to save $450 on a Hydro Pro rower. That's HYDROW.com, code ROW450.
Where are we right now? And where do you think, you explain to us how like a day can look like in a city for, we can say 2035. And also that we have this rapid development of machine learning right now. What is the future? Learning, parenting, war.
We are living in interesting times at the moment, over the lifetime of many people, I guess watching this, like it's likely that maybe the long term future destiny of Earth originating intelligent life will be decided one way or the other. So I think this transition to the machine intelligence era, there's still uncertainty about the exact timeline for that, but. I think it will be associated with significant existential risks. But also, conversely, if it goes well, it would also help us eliminate a whole bunch of other existential risks and really unlock like a radically expanded space of possibilities for human society and for human minds with unprecedented possibilities for human flourishing. And so my most recent book, which just came out like some small number of weeks ago, called Deep Utopia, looks at this other side of the coin. So whereas superintelligence kind of looked at what could go wrong exactly so that we could hopefully find ways to prevent it, Deep Utopia looks at what happens if things go right. Imagine we do develop machine superintelligence, we do solve this technical alignment problem. Imagine we also solve the governance problem to whatever extent it is solvable, but at least predominantly we end up using this technology for good and not to wage war or oppress one another, etc. Like take the sort of best case scenario. We then end up in a situation where we will have extremely advanced technologies, and think not just AI here, but then the superintelligence would help us develop all kinds of other technologies as well. We would, I think, start to approximate a condition relatively soon of technological maturity. So this would be a condition in which most important general technologies that are physically possible, that for which there is some possible pathway from where we are now to actually developing them, have been developed. So think all these science fiction stories where there are like all kind of futuristic technologies. Space colonization, perfect virtual realities, uploading human minds into computers, cures for aging, like all these kind of, but they're not physically impossible. They don't break any law of nature. They're just really hard. But maybe if we humans keep chugging away for like 20,000 years, we'll probably have a lot of these, right? If human civilization and science and technology But all of those things that we could expect in the long-term future, if we ourselves had to develop them, could happen in the short-term future once super intelligences are like responsible for driving this technological progress. So we have then the condition, I think, if things go well, of technological maturity or something approximating technological maturity, where human labor is obsolete because the machines, the AIs, the robots could do everything we could do better, cheaper, more efficiently. We have unprecedented control over the world and ourselves through these advanced technologies. And the challenge then is to conceive of what like a really fantastic human life would look like under these conditions of, I call it, a solved world, where basically all practical problems have been solved, or to the extent that they haven't been solved, AIs will anyway be much better at fixing them than anything that humans can do at that point.
And how many percentage do you think this can be reality? What do you think, like, how many percentage do you think the bad case? Because what I feel like is it like very hard to get a middle case. It's like a worst case or a best case. But maybe you know much more than me about this, so I have full respect for that. But what are your thoughts about this?
I actually agree with you that existential, like human extinction on the one hand, or some sort of utopia on the other, each of those might be more likely than a sort of mixed bag type of kind of good, but not really great, like sort of. So I do think, which might seem counterintuitive, because by like common sense heuristic, we normally expect the future to kind of resemble the past and like could get really bad or really good, right? But that seems to like, we normally think maybe of a normal distribution of outcomes and the more extreme. But I do think our expectations for the future should be more bimodal, like a kind of curve that has like is kind of lower in the middle and then have two bumps at towards the extreme. So think a little bit like if you had like a beam and then human civilization being a ball rolling along this beam, and eventually it will probably fall off the beam, but it's hard to predict whether it will fall off to the left or to the right. But like the longer the interval you consider, the less likely is that we will still continue to roll along this narrow beam. And so that's how I think about it. It's really, I think both possibilities have significant probability, like the kind of doom and the utopia. It's really hard. I think we have such profound ignorance about these things. We've never developed superintelligence before. We don't have much to go on. If you ask people who have thought along and hard about this problem for their P-doom, as it's now colloquially known, like probability of doom.
And doom is like the world ends. The world for humanity ends.
Humans would go extinct maybe in the P-doom in the doom scenario, all right? But there would still be AIs that would... Maybe they would be like these paperclip maximizing AIs. Or the equivalent. I mean, not literally paperclips, but some random arbitrary goal that doesn't include maybe like happy conscious humans with humor and music. But it is true, and it does become important actually exactly what your definition of doom is. So like scenarios in which like 1,000 years from now there aren't any beings very similar to what we are now, I think is fairly likely, but it doesn't have to be doomy, right? Like is like the best possible situation where like we exactly as we are now just keep doing our human things for 10 million years, like the same thing over and over, running around like for 70 years, and then like we get replaced with new people and we have like two legs and two arms and two eyes and our little brains keep, you know, being addicted to social media. Well, like at some point maybe nothing's enough and we could like unlock the next level. Like it's, if you're playing a video game, like at some point you've spent enough time on one level and you feel ready to kind of, and so at some point we might want to change human nature in some way, like maybe enhance our own minds or like expand our capabilities in different ways. So I think that would be many scenarios in which ultimately humanity in its current form ceases to exist, but that might nevertheless count as great success stories. If, for example, the people currently alive, instead of just being killed, have the opportunity slowly to continue to develop and grow. And, you know, maybe a few hundred years from now, we've gradually upgraded ourselves and used new medicine, and we like kind of eventually become quite different. But at no point was there like some big catastrophe. It was more like an unlocking of the future. Just as if you think of with an individual lifespan, take like a five-year-old, and then look at the same person 30 years later. Now they're 35. They are quite different. Like in terms of how they look, what they think, what they feel, like a lot of things have changed. But we don't think of that as a catastrophe for the five-year-old, right? That the five-year-old no longer is there, but what happened to them was that that was like a path forward where they continuously grew and developed and changed into this different being. And we, in fact, think that's good for the five-year-old, that they might, we might even think it would be kind of tragic if somehow you locked the five-year-old into forever only being a five-year-old and not being able to change in this way. And so I think analogously, we as a species might be like kind of a five-year-old, and that it's tragic that that we have so far never had a chance to grow up. Like why should you only be able to grow up for 20 years and then you plateau and then you sort of rot and decay? Like that's the way we are, but that's just because our cells happen to like senesce at a pace of several decades. But what if you could continue to grow up? Like you didn't stop growing and developing when you were like 20 or something, but you just got healthier and smarter and your memory improved and you could like appreciate more aspects of reality like for hundreds of years. Like we would just unlock whole new levels of personal maturity and development. And maybe that's like would be much morally better. It's just technologically not yet feasible. But in the future where this has become possible, maybe these post-human beings would look back on our current age and say, well, what a horror. Like we all died in our infancy. Like we all died, you know, before ever reaching 200 even. And it's the equivalent of like massive infant mortality. And so once one zooms out like this, there are a lot of these like everyday common like precepts, like things we just assume morally and about values that you really have to start to rethink from the ground up. Like we might have this very little parochial view about how things should be, but we've never even seen what the alternatives are. And so we shouldn't be too sort of confident that we've got all this figured out. And I think that we will eventually, if things go well, unlock this much vaster space of possible modes of being that will contain possibilities for us that some of which I think could be wonderful, literally beyond our ability to imagine.
If you compare the human brain with AI, we still have some qualifications that AI is missing. How far are we to make a breakthrough?
Well, if we look at the human brain, so we have sort of on the order of 100 billion neurons and maybe 100 trillion synapses, you know, give or take. And if we look at current, the biggest current AI models, they have a little bit fewer synapses. I think like maybe around a trillion parameters roughly is like where the biggest models are. So maybe like a factor of 100 less in terms of the parameter count than the human brain. On the other hand, they are faster. So human neurons operate on a time scale of, you know, maybe they can fire like 100 times per second at top speed. Whereas, of course, transistors are much faster than that. The human sort of biological brain isn't really improving, whereas computers are getting faster and cheaper by the year. And also more money is being spent on using the current chips we have to just make more of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the effective amount of compute applied to training leading-edge AI systems has been growing like extremely rapidly. you know, maybe doubling every 6 months or something like that for quite a long time. Part of that is just like Moore's law and improvements in the actual technology, but part is just like, it used to be that you spent like 10,000 to do like a training run, like in a little academic lab. Maybe you had $10,000 to buy computers with, but and now like we are approaching kind of $10 billion investments. Like, I think like XAI, Elon Musk's AI company, just signed some deal with NVIDIA to buy $10 billion of compute. And if that shows similar capability gains as we've seen in the previous steps, then that might unlock like the next level of investment, like $100 billion training runs, you know, 5 years from now, perhaps. So ultimately, I mean, if you plot, like we have the human brain starting at a high level, but not really improving. And then we have AI starting at like way below human level, rapidly improving and now approaching human level, but at a very steep incline. So at some point, in terms of raw processing power, and it comes a little bit hard to exactly measure. It's not clear that one synapse is exactly the equivalent to one parameter in a neural network, you know. But ballpark, it looks like we are approaching sort of processing equivalence of the human brain. And it's kind of interesting to see how, intuitively speaking, the capabilities that we see also are sort of approaching human level capabilities in some ways exceeding, but in some ways not quite there. So it is interesting that the actual performance we've managed to get, if you sort of squint and don't look too closely, seem to actually pretty closely match the amount of computation being applied to train and run these systems.
I want to talk a little bit about the spirit. What are your thoughts about what spirit is? And is it possible to put it in machine learning? Is it possible that the synopsis we have, it feels like it's an algorithm that's also, that we're feeling what we feel. And is that possible to put in the AI, the machine? If we get super intelligence, can the AI robots start to feel and start to know that they are alive, if you understand what I mean?
Yeah, so I think like, so you mean consciousness maybe, or?
Yeah, the personality, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a computationalist. So like this philosophical position that what makes a system conscious, if it is that it performs a certain kind of computation, a certain structure of information processing. So that what makes human brains generate conscious experiences doesn't really have anything fundamentally to do with the fact that they are made of carbon atoms or like that they're water molecules. It's like the fact that our brains perform various kinds of computations, and the same computations implemented on a different substrate would result in exactly the same phenomenal experiences.
Okay.
So I think in principle, definitely possible for computers to be conscious. You know, if they have is like similar capacity to the human brain and they were running a similar program to the human mind, then I think they would experience the same kind of experiences that the human would just running on their biological brain. And so in particular, I think uploading human minds into computers will be possible at technological maturity. If you could kind of scan a human brain at a sufficient level of resolution and implement the same computation, you know, on the silicon substrate, I think that would then be a mind experiencing the same things that the original human brain did. Now, if you don't run exactly the same computation, but you run some different kind of computation, like for example, the current large language models, they are not structured exactly like a human mind. I mean, they have some of the similar capabilities, but the actual algorithm is different. Then it becomes a lot harder to determine whether they are conscious or not, whether they have any subjective experiences or not. We don't have a very good theory of the necessary and sufficient conditions for a system to be conscious. But if you take off the shelf some of the best theories that have been proposed before, For example, a global workspace theory, attention schema theory, higher order representation theory, and you just like apply them to the case of these AI systems that we have, then it looks like either some current AI systems might possibly be conscious, or at least it would be possible using near-term technology to clubber together a system that would satisfy the criteria. And so what this means is that I think we can no longer really be confident that some of these systems we built might not have various forms and aspects of conscious experience. And that will be increasingly the case as we scale this up and make even more sophisticated minds. And note here that it doesn't require that they be fully equivalent to a human mind. Like we think many animals have the ability to experience like pain or pleasure or like have simple thoughts and perceptions. And so, you know, even if you just had like a mouse level AI, that potentially could have like mouse level experience. And then like more perhaps as you like scale it up. And this raises a big challenge. Like, so we already touched on two other big challenges with the AI transition. So that was the alignment problem, like the technical problem of like aligning superintelligences to the intentions of their creators. Then we have like the governance problem or like the political problem of if we could solve the technical alignment problem, how can we make sure we don't use them to like wage war or oppress one another or do bad things? And then there's this third problem now, which is the ethics of digital minds, that it might not matter just like what the AIs do to us or what we do to each other using AI tools, but also what we do to the AIs themselves. They might become moral patients. And for the future to go well, it might also need to go well for these digital minds themselves that we are building. And, you know, most minds in the future might be digital minds rather than biological minds. So it might matter a great deal, like how good the future is for them. But it does add like a whole extra dimension of difficulty to this challenge.
That's very interesting. Isn't like if I look like a gorilla at a gorilla and then a human body and a human brain, everybody would say that the human brain, even though the gorilla is maybe how many times stronger than a human, the human will always win in the end. And I feel like it's a little bit the same here, that if we create AI robots that are many, many, many times stronger, more powerful than us, smarter, they have they have instant development all the time. It must be like they also will win in the end.
Yeah, I think that's likely. And so the idea then would be to try to design them in such a way that they're on our side, that they are like an extension of our own volition as opposed to this antagonistic force. You know, just like if you have a child, like you're maybe smarter, no more and stronger, but if you love the child, it's kind of good for the child that the more you know and the stronger you are, like the more you can do to help it. And so similarly, if the AIs are designed such that, well, they love us or they respect us or they share our values or they want to do what we ask them to do, like there are different versions of this, but in each of those cases, it might be that their strength is actually to our advantage because they're like, you know, on our team and helping us.
I have a 6-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. And I have thought about a lot about right now, what can be the meaning of life in 20, 30 years? And also what is the most important for them to learn? When I was in school, we was reading about, you know, kings and queens and, you know, a lot of stuff that I'm not using right now at all. But what is the most important for the kids right now, the small kids? What will be their values in like 20, 30, 40 years?
Yeah, that's a real ponderer. I I think, well, first, I guess it makes sense to hedge one's bet a little bit. So it might be this whole AI thing unfolds before they grow up or like before their career is over, right? But we don't know for sure. So it makes sense at least. You don't want to end up in a situation where they are 20 and they just assumed by now we would have super intelligence, so they never learned anything and never developed any skills, and now they're
kind right.
You want to like at least cover the basics to sort of make sure. Now, but to the extent that you do think these transitions are going to happen, it does cast things in a different light. I think one thing is that maybe one would want to focus more on just enjoying a childhood as opposed to seeing the childhood as preparation for something else. So we like school system is kind of set up to prepare children to become economically productive workers.
Right.
Like you place them at their desk, you tell them to sit, they are assigned tasks, they are graded on how well they do. And this is like what you need if you then want office workers to do this as adults. And right now, we do need a whole bunch of office workers, so we have no choice than to force our kids to do that, right? But if we didn't need all these office workers, then maybe there would be a different way, a better way of bringing up children that would not focus on training them to be economically productive, but like training them to have good lives, to enjoy lives, to appreciate art and beauty and cultivate like the fine art of conversation and, you know, physical wellness, hobbies, appreciation of nature, humor, music, like all these things. Mm. And just having fun being kids as well. Like that's one thing that kids tend to often be better at than we adults is to actually enjoy life. A lot of kids are really highly skilled at that. Like, you know, make up games, laugh, have fun, like explore, learn. So that's like a comparative advantage that kids have. And now to the extent that we focus specifically on learning skills, it's hard to know. I mean, I guess like learning a bit of computer science stuff is kind of learning to use current AI tools. And so that maybe you could be an early adopter. Being flexible and adaptable. So like learning to learn, learning to be able to take the initiative yourself to train up in a new field rather than assuming that you will sort of learn once the skill you will need for a lifetime and then just kind of keep doing the same thing. So feeling empowered to like, so right now there are so many resources. Like you don't have to enroll in some formal course if you want to learn something. You could go to YouTube or to Khan Academy or just like getting that sense that be curious about things and feel that you yourself can actually learn things by just taking the initiative and go out and, you know, find it out for yourself. I think that's valuable. That might also be like, I don't know, this like some period where like certain human skills are a little bit, maybe it takes longer to fully automate. So there might be like need for nurses and stuff longer than there will be need for certain other professions, like legal research assistant might be easier to automate, like with these large language models. Like if the task is like read through all of these past legal precedents to find one that's relevant to the current case, like that's the kind of thing that current LLMs are really good at. Whereas like being a nurse in a hospital that like, you know, give comfort to like the old and frail and help, you know, change their plasters and stuff like that, that might take a bit longer to get that to be automated. So, it is a strange situation to be in that there is so much uncertainty about the long-term future. And if you think about the young kid today, like even without any technological changes, like they might, you know, they might be alive 80, 90 years from now, right? Even without any medical progress or anything, just like from the baseline. And then if you add sort of, you know, plausible medical progress, like maybe they have like a 100-year runway, and like just think of how much things will change in 100 years. Even setting aside AI, and then if AI comes in, like, you know, the sky is the limit.
What is the most incredible stuff that you have heard about compared to if you talk about the AI? Like, if you have seen anything about the cancer, if you've seen anything, you talk to some science friend to you that say like, okay, I heard about this. Is it something that you say, wow, I have like, you know, write books about this, but this was crazy.
Well, I think it's a moving target. So things that used to be like that, a little while later, people just shrug and say, yeah, of course people, like, of course computers can play chess better than any human grandmaster. Like, and like, of course they can play Go. Well, of course they can like fold proteins better than any human expert, like with AlphaFold DeepMind system. Mm. You know, of course they can talk to us and make up poems in just a few seconds and solve university level exams in pretty much any subject, and we just become numbed. Like we start like things that are extremely impressive at the time, like 6 months later people just shrug, and I think that makes it harder to appreciate just the sequence of remarkable advances that we've already seen. But I think, yeah, these large language models that we currently see, like GPT-4, Omni, I guess is the current, and Claude 3, another large language model by Anthropic, and I think they are like extremely impressive. And if people haven't used these systems,
what do they do?
Well, you. If we take, for example, GPT-4 Omni. Now, this is the most recent thing that OpenAI released. So you can talk to it and ask it questions, and it speaks back to you. So if you are curious about any random thing, chances are it will be able to give you a good answer. You can also have it analyze a bunch of text. I think you can put in several books worth of text and have it summarize it or answer questions related to what's in the text. It can help you code if you want to make a program. It's like, it just like you ask, like, oh, can you make a program that does this? And it just spews out computer code. It can do a whole host of other things. Like if you're a kid trying to learn some subject, you could just ask it, I'm a kid trying to learn this subject. Can you make some exercise questions for me? And then when I'm answering it, rather than just telling me the answer, can you sort of help give me hints so that I can train myself to, like, all of that stuff works really well. And it's really impressive. And I'd suggest anybody who hasn't already played around with these, like, it would be a good idea to do, both to get a general sense of where AI is and to learn to use these tools, and also because I think they're actually practically useful in many ways for just, yeah, random things. Like, a lot of the, like, question answering, like, you could Google stuff instead, and if you browse around a few web pages, maybe you could yourself find the answer, but it's just, like, easier sometimes just to, you know, open the app and just speak your question, and then it comes, like the actual answer comes back directly without you having to sort of click through a bunch of different websites.
And can you explain a little bit about Deeptopia, your latest book?
Yeah, so this then is really, and it covers a lot of things, but like at the heart, it's a philosophical book, and which explores this question of what would a good human life look like in a solved world? Where a solved world is one that has attained the condition of technological maturity. We talked about that earlier. And also sort of the governance problems are solved to whatever extent the governance problems can be solved. So like imagine we have a good, well-ordered society and that's fair and just and inclusive and the super advanced technology. But then given then what would a good human life look like? And so there are sort of layers to this onion that one can like approach this question more or less superficially. So like at the outermost layer, you have questions come up with unemployment. So like, well, if you start having kind of AIs that can do more human jobs, then you will have some maybe dislocations on the labor market. And the answer to that would be, well, you know, maybe you need to retrain people to do different jobs. Like if, you know, certain, like just as we all used to be farmers 100 years ago, basically, like the vast majority of people worked in agriculture, and now there are much fewer farm jobs, but there are other jobs. And so people will have, you know, have left the farms and, you know, started doing other things instead. And maybe there needs to be some unemployment support while people, you know, who are laid off can retrain. And like, so all those standard answers, like that's kind of the most superficial layer. Now if we kind of then get to the second layer of the onion, we have like the realization that, well, actually it's different because it's not just some jobs that get replaced with other jobs, but in this condition, all human economic labor would become obsolete, with a few exceptions, but that we could talk about. But first approximation, no more need for human economic effort.
Mm.
So the goal here is full on employment. This is kind of what AI is trying to achieve, right? Not just to be able to do a few things automatically, but to be able to do everything, automate all human. So that's a much more radical conception. And there, you know, if that's the layer you're like trying to analyze this, that the answer might look something like, well, if we don't have to work for a living anymore, then, you know, maybe we would need to change the education system, as we talked a bit about, to train people to appreciate life and to live well, as opposed to being like economically productive, and culture would have to change. Like maybe, you know, governments would focus, you know, more on I don't know, building like parks and like leisure activity. Like there's like a whole big transition, which I think could be done and would need be big change, and a lot of work would have to be put into making sure that that goes well. But I think in principle, it could be done. And there are already various demographics that who don't work for a living. We mentioned children who are economically useless. They don't contribute economically to the world, but they still have great lives in many cases. And retired people, like if they are in perfect health, like often like really enjoy life and get more. And like there are people who are independently wealthy, like some of those have great lives. And so. But I think there's like a couple of more layers of this onion that if we want to go deeper into this. So one other layer is to realize that actually it's not just economic labor that becomes unnecessary in this condition of a solid world, but a whole range of other instrumental activities that we humans engage in. So even people who don't work for a living for money, they still do a whole bunch of other stuff because they have to. So, you know, maybe you spend time like, you know, gardening because you want to get your garden in a nice condition. Maybe you have to take out the trash because otherwise the trash just piles up. Maybe if you want to find really nice things to clothes to wear or to put in your house, you have to go shopping and spend time looking around in different stores to find just the right item, right? Like, or you could get by with less good items, but if you want like the perfect thing, you would have to like invest time and effort and attention to achieve. So there's all kinds of things that people do when they don't have to work, but that still engages their activity that requires effort and planning, etc. But that would also go away if you think about it. So like you could have the automated robot gardener, right? Like you could also take out the trash. Like as for shopping, you could have a recommender system that would be much better at picking out things that you would really like than you would be able to do yourself. And it could also buy them on your behalf. And so in this scenario, maybe you could still go shopping if you're one of those people who enjoy that, but it would seem kind of pointless if the end result of walking around and with the plastic bags is you come home and what you get is actually worse than if you have just let your sort of recommender agent just buy it for you. So it kind of creates a sense of pointlessness, all these activities. Like if the end result is actually worse than if you just let the AI do it for you. So you get the kind of post-instrumental condition. And in fact, there is like yet another layer. So you might still think in this scenario, okay, so maybe I don't have to like do the gardening or the shopping, take out the trash and like, but there's still some things. Like if you want to be fit, you have to, you know, go to the gym or something, right? Like you can't hire a robot to run on the treadmill on your behalf, it seems, right? Like that, there's such a thing. Like similarly, if you want to learn mathematics, let's say you actually have to study mathematics. You can't just pay a robot to learn it on your behalf. Like then you don't know it. But actually, I think you would also have a condition, not just of post-instrumentality, but of plasticity, a plastic world, or where we ourselves, our human bodies, our human minds, our psychological states become malleable to our wishes. So yes, you might not be able to hire a robot to go to the gym on your behalf, but you could pop a pill that would induce the same physiological effects in your body.
Do you think that will be possible?
Yeah. So at technological maturity, this certainly seems like one of the affordances. Whatever the particular chemicals that are released when you exercise that triggers the body to sort of build up the muscles slightly stronger and get like all of that stuff.
Cool.
And even more, like with a learning example of learning mathematics, I think that at technological maturity, you could have shortcuts to that. Like, you know, it's easiest maybe to see if you're already uploaded, where you could directly edit the synaptic matrix of your mind to change it into a configuration that would constitute you having various mathematical concepts and knowledge. But even with a biological brain, I think you could approximate that at least through sort of advanced brain editing technologies that superintelligence would be able to invent.
When do you think it's possible to upload your brain and, when you are dying, still live in the computer?
Yeah, my guess is after we have superintelligence. And that it will then be the superintelligence that perfects the technology to do this.
And how long time is that?
Well, I think like however long it takes to get superintelligence plus just a little bit, I'd imagine it might follow fairly quickly in the wake of superintelligence. Like, I don't know whether it would be like months or years after you have superintelligence that you would get this, or maybe I doubt that it would be many decades after you have the kind of research being performed at digital speeds.
But when do you think superintelligence will be? Or I know that you have asked a lot of scientists also, when do you think a superintelligence will be with the, like around 50% or something? But when do you think we will have superintelligence in the world?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you ask like a 50% probability, it might be like in something like 10 years or something like that. It's hard to say. Like, I think there's like a substantial chance of it happening within, you know, some like single digit number of years or thereabouts.
Interesting.
Well, that also means there's like a 50% chance it could take longer, right? So it's like
we
have to like this. It's very tempting to sort of pick one thing that you think seems undone, but really, if you step back, we are. It's hard to predict future technological advances and fundamental transformations, and different smart people have different views. And so I think epistemically, I have to recognize the uncertainty here and kind of think in terms of probability distributions rather than like completely convincing yourself of one particular possibility.
I will put the link to your book also here for everybody looking on YouTube and listening to the podcast. And I want to say thank you very much, Nick, that you have visited the podcast, and so interesting to talk about you. I know that we can talk a lot of hours more, but we will start with this. So thank you very, very much that you're taking your time.
I enjoyed talking with you, Alexander. Thanks for having me.
Framgangspodden with Alexander Perleros.
Tack för att du lyssnade på det här avsnittet. Hoppas du kände att det var meningsfullt. Om du inte redan visste det så finns vi också på YouTube där du kan titta på avsnittet. Och sen så kan du signa upp dig på nyhetsbrevet där vi varje vecka skickar ut de absolut bästa tipsen från avsnittet direkt till din inkorg. Det är faktiskt väldigt smart. Och sen finns vi på TikTok och Instagram också där vi lägger upp de mest intressanta sakerna från avsnittet. Så ett stort, stort tack igen. Och ha en fantastisk vecka.
Discover Hydro, the best kept secret in fitness. Hydro is the state-of-the-art at-home rower that engages 86% of your muscles, delivering the ultimate full-body workout in just 20 minutes. From advanced to beginner, Hydro has over 500 classes, shot worldwide and taught by Olympians and world-class athletes. For a 30-day risk-free trial, go to Hydro.com and use code ROW450 to save $450 on a Hydro Pro rower. That's HYDROW.com, code ROW450.
Hi, this is Farnoosh Tarabi, host of the Webby-winning podcast, So Money. If you're aiming for a goal, be it saving for a house, growing your family, or retiring, life makes it difficult to stay the course. But with a dedicated Merrill advisor, you get a personalized plan and a clear path forward. Having the bull at your back helps your whole financial life move with you. So when your plans change, Merrill's with you every step of the way. Go to ml.com/bullish to learn more. Merrill, a Bank of America company. What would you like the power to do? Investing involves risk. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.